Organizing the people is the process in which the revolutionary leaders, who are also prevented from saying their own word, initiate the experience of learning how to name the world. This is true learning experience, and therefore dialogical. So it is that the leaders cannot say their word alone. They must say it with the people. Leaders who do not act dialogically, but insist on imposing their decisions, do not organize the people. They manipulate them. They do not liberate, nor are they liberated. They oppress. The fact that the leaders who organize the people do not have the right to arbitrarily impose their word does not mean that they must therefore take a liberalist position which would encourage license among the people who are accustomed to oppression. The dialogical theory of action opposes both authoritarianism and license, and thereby affirms authority and freedom. There is no freedom without authority, but there is also no authority without freedom. All freedom contains the possibility that under special circumstances and at different existential levels, it may become authority. Freedom and authority cannot be isolated, but must be considered in relationship to each other. Authentic authority is not affirmed as such by mere transfer of power, but through delegation or in sympathetic adherence. If authority is merely transferred from one group to another, or is imposed upon the majority, it degenerates into authoritarianism. Authority can avoid conflict with freedom only if it is freedom become authority. Hypertrophy of the one provokes atrophy of the other. Just as authority cannot exist without freedom and vice versa, authoritarianism cannot exist without denying freedom, nor license without denying authority. In the theory of dialogical action, organization requires authority, so it cannot be authoritarian. It requires freedom, so it cannot be licentious. Organization is rather a highly educational process in which leaders and people together experience true authority and freedom, which they then seek to establish in society by transforming the reality which mediates them. Cultural synthesis. Cultural action is always a systematic and deliberate form of action which operates upon the social structure, either with the objective of preserving that structure or of transforming it. As a form of deliberate and systematic action, all cultural action has its theory which determines its ends and thereby defines its methods. Cultural action either serves domination, consciously or unconsciously, or it serves the liberation of men and women. As these dialectically opposed types of cultural action operate in and upon the social structure, they create dialectical relations of permanence and change. The social structure, in order to be, must become. In other words, becoming is the way the social structure expresses duration in the Bergsonian sense of the term. Dialogical cultural action does not have as its aim the disappearance of the permanence change dialectic, an impossible aim since disappearance of the dialectic would require the disappearance of the social structure itself and thus of men. It aims rather at surmounting the antagonistic contradictions of the social structure, thereby achieving the liberation of human beings. Anti-dialogical cultural action, on the other hand, aims at mythicizing such contradictions, thereby hoping to avoid or hinder in so far as possible the radical transformation of reality. Anti-dialogical action explicitly or implicitly aims to preserve, within the social structure, situations which favor its own agents. While the latter would never accept a transformation of the structure sufficiently radical to overcome its antagonistic contradictions, they may accept reforms which do not affect their power of decision over the oppressed. Hence, this modality of action involves the conquest of the people, their division, their manipulation, and cultural invasion. It is necessarily and fundamentally an induced action. Dialogical action, however, is characterized by the supersedence of any induced aspect. The incapacity of anti-dialogical cultural action to supersede its induced character results from its objective, domination. The capacity of dialogical cultural action to do this lies in its objective, liberation. In cultural invasion, the actors draw the thematic content of their action from their own values and ideology. Their starting point is their own world, from which they enter the world of those they invade. In cultural synthesis, the actors who come from another world to the world of the people do so not as invaders. They do not come to teach or to transmit or to give anything, but rather to learn with the people about the people's world. In cultural invasion, the actors who need not even go personally to the invaded culture, increasingly their action is carried out by technological instruments, superimpose themselves on the people, who are assigned the role of spectators of objects. In cultural synthesis, the actors become integrated with the people, who are co-authors of the action that both perform upon the world. In cultural invasion, both the spectators and the reality to be preserved are objects of the actor's action. In cultural synthesis, there are no spectators. The object of the actor's action is the reality to be transformed for the liberation of men. Cultural synthesis is thus a mode of action for confronting culture itself, as the preserver of the very structures by which it was formed. Cultural action, as historical action, is an instrument for superseding the dominant alienated and alienating culture. In this sense, every authentic revolution is a cultural revolution. The investigation of the people's generative themes or meaningful thematics described in Chapter 3 constitutes the starting point for the process of action as a cultural synthesis. Indeed, it is not really possible to divide this process into two separate steps. First, thematic investigation and then action as a cultural synthesis. Such a dichotomy would imply an initial phase in which the people, as passive objects, would be studied, analyzed, and investigated by the investigators, a procedure congruent with anti-dialogical action. Such division would lead to the naive conclusion that action as synthesis follows from action as invasion. In dialogical theory, this division cannot occur. The subjects of thematic investigation are not only the professional investigators, but also the men and women of the people whose thematic universe is being sought. Investigation, the first moment of action as cultural synthesis, establishes a climate of creativity which will tend to develop in the subsequent stages of action. Such a climate does not exist in cultural invasion, which through alienation kills the creative enthusiasm of those who are invaded, leaving them hopeless and fearful of risking experimentation, without which there is no true creativity. Those who are invaded, whatever their level, rarely go beyond the models which the invaders prescribe for them. In cultural synthesis, there are no invaders, hence there are no imposed models. In their stead, there are actors who critically analyze reality, never separating this analysis from action, and intervene as subjects in the historical process. Instead of following predetermined plans, leaders and people mutually identified, together create the guidelines of their action. In this synthesis, leaders and people are somehow reborn in new knowledge and new action. Knowledge of the alienated culture leads to transforming action, resulting in a culture which is being freed from alienation. The more sophisticated knowledge of the leaders is remade in the empirical knowledge of the people, while the latter is refined by the former. In cultural synthesis, and only in cultural synthesis, is it possible to resolve the contradiction between the worldview of the leaders and that of the people, to the enrichment of both. Cultural synthesis does not deny the differences between the two views. Indeed, it is based on these differences. It does deny the invasion of one by the other, but affirms the undeniable support each gives to the other. Revolutionary leaders must avoid organizing themselves apart from the people, whatever contradiction to the people may occur fortuitously due to certain historical conditions must be solved, not augmented by the cultural invasion of an imposed relationship. Cultural synthesis is the only way. Revolutionary leaders commit many errors and miscalculations by not taking into account something so real as the people's view of the world, a view which explicitly and implicitly contains their concerns, their doubts, their hopes, their way of seeing the leaders, their perceptions of themselves and of the oppressors, their religious beliefs, almost always syncretic, their fatalism, their rebellious reactions. None of these elements can be seen separately, for in interaction all of them compose a totality. The oppressor is interested in knowing this totality only as an aid to his action of invasion in order to dominate or preserve domination. For the revolutionary leaders, the knowledge of this totality is indispensable to their action as cultural synthesis. Cultural synthesis, precisely because it is a synthesis, does not mean that the objectives of revolutionary action should be limited by the aspirations expressed in the worldview of the people. If this were to happen, in the guise of respect for that view, the revolutionary leaders would be passively bound to that vision. Neither invasion by the leaders of the people's worldview, nor mere adaptation by the leaders to the often naive aspirations of the people is acceptable. To be concrete, if at any given historical moment the basic aspiration of the people goes no further than a demand for salary increases, the leaders can commit one of two errors. They can limit their action to stimulating this one demand, or they can overrule this popular aspiration and substitute something more far-reaching, but something which has not yet come to the forefront of the people's attention. In the first case, the revolutionary leaders follow a line of adaptation to the people's demands. In the second case, by disrespecting the aspirations of the people, they fall into cultural invasion. The solution lies in synthesis. The leaders must, on the one hand, identify with the people's demand for higher salaries, while on the other, they must pose the meaning of that very demand as a problem. By doing this, the leaders pose as a problem a real, concrete historical situation of which the salary demand is one dimension. It will thereby become clear that salary demands alone cannot comprise a definitive solution. The essence of this solution can be found in the previously cited statement by bishops of the Third World that if the workers do not somehow come to be owners of their own labor, all structural reforms will be ineffective. They must be the owners, not sellers of their labor, for any purchase or sale of labor is a type of slavery. To achieve critical consciousness of the facts that is necessary to be the owner of one's own labor, that labor constitutes part of the human person, and that a human being can neither be sold nor can he sell himself, is to go a step beyond the deception of palliative solutions. It is to engage in authentic transformation of reality in order, by humanizing that reality, to humanize women and men. In the anti-dialogical theory of action, cultural invasion serves the ends of manipulation, which in turn serves the ends of conquest, and conquest the ends of domination. Cultural synthesis serves the ends of organization. Organization serves the ends of liberation. This work deals with a very obvious truth. Just as the oppressor, in order to oppress, needs a theory of oppressive action, so the oppressed, in order to become free, also need a theory of action. The oppressor elaborates his theory of action without the people, for he stands against them. Nor can the people, as long as they are crushed and oppressed, internalizing the image of the oppressor, construct by themselves the theory of their liberating action. Only in the encounter of the people with the revolutionary leaders, in their communion, in their praxis, can this theory be built. A Luta Continua, Afterward to Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Ira Shaw, College of Staten Island, CUNY, USA. Now I am no longer part of the masses. I am people and I can demand my rights. Francisca Andrade, student in a Freire literary circle in Angicos, 1963, Kirkendale, 40. The Angikos Literary Circle celebrated its final meeting April 2, 1963, with not only Paulo Freire in attendance, but also the Liberal President of the Republic, João Goulart. Freire told the President, "There exists today a people who decides, a people that is rising up, a people that has begun to become aware of its destiny and has begun to take part in the Brazilian historical process irreversibly." Kirkendall 40. At that ceremony, another dignitary attending was General Humberto Castelo Branco, who 1 year later, almost to the day, would reverse democracy by overthrowing Goulart, crushing Paulo's national program, and throwing Paulo in jail. The lights went out in Brazil for too many years after that. Perhaps I can say that this book was born in the dark, or better, born against the dark, or better yet, born for hope and resistance against oppression. Part of an advancing democratic movement in Brazil, Freire's method taught illiterates to read and write in only 40 hours of inexpensive instruction. Once basically literate, poor peasants and workers could finally qualify to vote after a very long silence imposed from the top down, vastly expanding the electorate from the bottom up. If thousands of Freirean cultural circles had opened as planned after that terrible April 1964, millions of working-class illiterates would read and write well enough to register as new voters, pulling political power to the majority. To stop such a democratic possibility, the oligarchy and its army overthrew the elected Goulart administration, which had appointed Freire to his national post. Interrogated and jailed, Freire was forced to leave the country. He then wandered the world with his wife Elsa and 5 children until 1980, his books banned in Brazil, evicted from his homeland in the prime of his political life. Others who could not escape were imprisoned, beaten, or hounded as the generals restored a conservative elite to unaccountable power. In the years ahead, Paulo would use his survival well, addressing large crowds in Europe and North America, as well as consulting with governments, NGOs, and local projects, becoming the most famous educator of his time, as well as a foremost advocate for social justice, producing a pedagogy of the oppressed while the wounds of the coup were still fresh. Problem-posing education is revolutionary futurity. Any situation in which some individuals prevent others from engaging in the process of inquiry is one of violence. 65-66. Few books have been so widely debated, quoted, excerpted, and also used for teacher education, graduate and undergraduate courses, and in some high schools, as the banning of this book in Tucson in 2012 showed. 50 years later, what can explain the extraordinary appeal of Pedagogy of the Oppressed? In 4 brief chapters, Paulo Freire integrated a remarkable array of concerns. 1. A theory and a practice for a critical pedagogy to question the status quo in the name of social justice. 2. The theory and practice involved a situated pedagogy which could be adapted for diverse places, different stakeholders, and varying conditions. 3. The situated pedagogy provided a rich lexicon of practice, a dialogue method of instruction, problem-posing inquiry instead of banking pedagogy, memorization, untested feasibility, limit situations and limit acts, the cultural circle, the teacher-student with students' teachers, the vocabulary universe, the generative theme and the generative word, codification and decodification. Conscientization, or coming to critical consciousness, hinged themes, and the anthropological notion of culture, praxis or action reflection, cyclically theorizing practice and practicing theory. 4. This lexicon for critical theory and practice evolved as Paulo experimented before the coup for 15 years in adult literacy education outside formal school systems. Later it would be adapted for K-12, and higher education units. 5. Open to diverse settings for critical practice, This book crossed paths with multicultural, anti-racist and feminist pedagogies and movements also emerging at that time with similar orientations toward equality, democracy, and social justice. 6. The social justice orientation of this book appeared just when mass movements for radical change became global phenomena, in a period famous for the immense and proliferating criticizability of things, institutions and practices and discourses, as Michel Foucault put it, 6, and when student-centered approaches and constructivist methods were on the offensive in educational circles. 7. Student-centered, constructivist and critical of inequality, Freire's theory and practice proposed all education as politics. No pedagogy can be neutral, because all develop human subjects and produce consciousness one way or another, depending on the ideology of the contents, the social relations of discourse, and the learning process of the curriculum. Any pedagogy or curriculum which does not question the status quo tacitly or actively endorses it. 8. This learning process offered appealing moral values based in ethics of mutuality and professional responsibility to teach for a world less violent and cruel. Freire's preoccupation with humanization and dehumanization launched this concern on the very first page. 9. Finally, Chapter 4 is an extraordinary epistle to would-be revolutionary leaders, not merely advice for critical educators. It rebukes oppositional leaders who denounce domination but slide into authoritarian monologue, exhortation, abstractness, bureaucratic rule, and propagandizing, not permissible in Freirean classrooms. These points help account for the longevity and impact of this small book, which was not written as a scholastic treatise, but rather grew from Freire's reflection on his practice and experiences. Thought and study alone did not produce Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Freire wrote in the preface. This book, he reported, is rooted in concrete situations and describes the reaction of laborers, peasant or urban, and of middle-class persons whom I have observed directly or indirectly during the course of my educative work, page 19. Paulo considered critical education in schools or in social movements intellectually demanding and politically risky. Movements with internal education programs confront formidable authorities who Paulo called the power now in power. In schools and colleges, teachers and students make themselves each day, but under terms largely dominated from outside and above, limit situations against which critical pedagogy is a limit act. Paulo was especially oriented to the critical learning possible inside mass movements, the power not yet in power, but found himself appointed Secretary of Education for Sao Paulo's 643 schools when the Workers' Party won control of that city administration in 1989. For Paulo, throughout his life and work, the essential questions of this famous book remained. What kind of world do we live in? Why is it like that? What kind of world do we want? How do we get there from here? April 2017, New York, USA. Interviews with contemporary scholars. Marina Aparicio Barberan, Paulo Freire Institute, Spain. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I'm a political scientist with an undergraduate degree from Pompeu Fabra University, and I specialize in public and social policy analysis and evaluation, with two master's degrees from UPF John Hopkins and Valencia UVEG. My research areas are policy analysis, political and electoral behavior, and political and parliamentary elites analysis. How did you come to read Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed for the first time? My first time reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed was in 2006. I was a participant and collaborative member of the Centro de Recursos y Educación Continua, CREC, Deputación de Valencia, directed by Pep Aparicio Guadas, 1999 to 2013. In the center, I conducted publishing tasks and took on organizational and educational functions related to my training and field. At the same time, I continued with my studies in political science, as well as various activities within social movements. Previously, I had read some of Freire's other works, but I think it is important to note how this book enticed me, the analysis, the words, and the way Freire articulates the different realities in which we are all immersed, his concretion, his ideas, his clairvoyance, his coherence. We could say that books like Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Pedagogy of the Question, or Pedagogy of Hope have been the key in shaping a perspective or dynamic of reading the world, and also writing the world and the word, and in putting this perspective into action. What do you think Paulo Freire would say about how his theories are used today? From my perspective, Freire would have mixed feelings. On the one hand, the joy of seeing his utopia, practices and theories, his way of living and doing having mushroomed in the world and society at the hands of women and men involved in processes of subjectivity and or awareness. On the other hand, Freire would have a certain desolation to see the fallacious use of many of his concepts in practical domestication, in universities, governments, and social movements. He also would have a certain perplexity, seeing how much of the analysis and how many of the arguments he included in Pedagogy of the Oppressed could be used in the present time. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? A Freirean university would have at its core the methodological action or theoretical and practical intervention which would lead to an awakened practice and promote a participatory or collaborative culture at the university. That is, we would be at a university where the process of awareness through dialogue and continued questioning between peers would lead to the construction of a process of liberation. Thus, we would be able to de-apprehend those dynamics, actions, procedures that we all have internalized in order to move toward a democratic, flexible, open, common society where we could overcome the sectarianism we are involved in as a subject and become thinking men, women, and children, and not oppressed subjects. If students took just one thing away from reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed, what would you hope it would be? I cannot be limited to picking just one thing. I would choose the dialogic method and emancipation method, the problem conception of politics, ethics, and education. I would choose critical analysis of specific realities. But above all, I would choose the proposal that reading the world precedes reading the word, and both the world and the word are in constant transformation, and we are always main characters in these actions. Noam Chomsky, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, USA. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. Linguistics, cognitive science, philosophy. What do you think Paulo Freire would say about how his theories are used today? I think he would be generally appalled by the current teach-to-test doctrines. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? Instruction should reject the notion of education as pouring water into a vessel, in a phrase used in the Enlightenment, Freire's banking model, in favor of engaging students in an active quest for understanding in a faculty-student cooperative environment. To a significant extent, something like that is true of science teaching, at its best, sometimes elsewhere. If students took just one thing away from reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed, what would you hope it would be? They should recognize that education should be a process of self-discovery, of developing one's own capacities and pursuing interests and concerns with an open and independent mind, all in cooperation with others. Gustavo E. Fishman, Arizona State University, USA. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I'm a professor of educational policy and director of EdExchange, the Knowledge Mobilization Initiative at the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College, Arizona State University. I started to work in education as a popular educator in the early 1980s in Argentina without any formal training in either pedagogy or research. Popular education at that time was closely related to Freirean ideals and was oriented to work in a non-authoritarian but guided pedagogical approach with the goal of social liberation. How did you come to read Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed for the first time? The first time I heard anything about Pedagogy of the Oppressed was not an invitation to read it, but an order to ignore it. In 1977, I was a 16-year-old studying industrial chemistry in a vocational school in Buenos Aires. I was not particularly politicized, but like everyone else in the country, I was acutely aware that we were living under a brutal dictatorship. It still makes me angry recalling how baffled I felt when the principal at my high school posted notes following the guidelines of the Ministry of Education announcing that the simple possession of any of the books on the list of immoral and dangerous readings was evidence of terrorist sympathies and reason enough to be expelled from the school. I remember that I became very curious that a book about education made it into this long list of dangerous books. 7 years later, and in September 1984, I was a member of a popular education group volunteering in a shanty town in Buenos Aires for an adult literacy project when my partner told me the International Council of Adult Education, ICAE, was looking for volunteers to organize their 1985 annual meeting. The keynote speaker was Paulo Freire, who was returning to Argentina for the first time since his books were banned in the country. I immediately volunteered to be part of the team that was organizing the meeting, and I got a used copy of Pedagogy of the Oppressed and began my informal education of all things Freirean. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? Following Freire's dictum of being simple without being simplistic, a Freirean university should have three key defining characteristics. First, it should be structured to implement a pedagogy of liberation committed to the principles of freedom, equity, inclusivity, and solidarity. A pedagogy of liberation will engage in curious, rigorous, and usable teaching, service, and research agendas. Second, the students, faculty, and administration should be as diverse as their societies. Diversity in two different but related senses, serving diverse sectors and all social groups of a society, as well as diversity of ideas and orientations. Third, a Freirean university will be organized as a laboratory of democratic participatory governing. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on pedagogy? I think the biggest impact of Freire's work is that it has demonstrated how even short-lived experiences of democratic schooling in a single classroom in or outside schools with children or adults are worth pursuing. These experiences teach us to not only expect more from ourselves as educators and learners, but also link individual and social actions with the goals of equality and solidarity. Ramon Fletcher, University of Barcelona, Spain. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I am devoted to scientific research in search of both intellectual and human excellence, focusing on the identification of actions that tackle inequalities in different social fields, ethnic and minority groups, gender issues, especially in the field of masculinity studies, education and economy, specifically focusing on organizations that are successful in overcoming income inequalities, etc. In other words, I've never been interested in the analysis of inequality by itself, because I think such analysis benefits only the people who develop it. Rather, I'm interested in the analysis of human actions that are actively overcoming inequalities, something that Freire appreciated very much. What do you think Paulo Freire would say about how his theories are used today? I do not know what Freire would think, but what I can say is that Freire had a great intuition and was always ahead of his time. In 1969, with Pedagogy of the Oppressed, he had already developed a theory of dialogic action, which did not arrive in the social sciences until 1981, 12 years later, with Habermas's theory of communicative action. What Frege defined as dialogic action or dialogic perspective is the current trend in social sciences in the field of economics, sociology, anthropology, and political science. I think Frege would be satisfied to see how the social sciences today are in line with the dialogic perspective that he foresaw in the 1960s. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Frege's work has had an impact on research? I think the impact of Frege's work on research has been extremely positive. The dialogic perspective helped show that it is necessary to open a dialogue with the people who are the object of study. What happens is that the meaning of this dialogue, what dialogue meant to Frege, has often not been well understood. Research should be truly dialogic with the end users of a given study. Although the subject may be a person working 8 hours a day in domestic cleaning, the researcher is being paid to read and study the scientific knowledge. Unfortunately, some people have understood only the go and dialogue with the subject's part, without doing the rest of their job, without working hard like Frege did, without reading the applicable social sciences literature so that they can use that knowledge in the dialogue with the end users. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Frege's work has had an impact on pedagogy? Honestly, Frege's work has had an impressive impact worldwide. Frege is possibly the most influential scholar in education. The problem is that this influence has not always reached educational practice. For example, in universities, many people declare themselves as being Freirean, but they are not helping transform the actual conditions of the schools or the educational practices to be in line with Freirean guidelines. If students took just one thing away from reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed, what would you hope it would be? I especially wish students would prioritize something that is forgotten in most educational systems, which is the right to education for all children. Very often, decisions are made based on reasons that are very far from the improvement of educational outcomes for all children. It is critical that students in education embrace this ethical and human commitment. This will be their real professional task. Ronald David Glass, University of California, Santa Cruz, USA. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I'm a radical philosopher of education whose work emanates from and within struggles for justice. I direct the UC Center for Collaborative Research for an Equitable California, and we partner with aggrieved communities to address issues in the economy, employment, education, housing, food systems, public health, and the environment. I also head a project that investigates the ethical issues in social science research. What do you think Paulo Freire would say about how his theories are used today? I had the great good fortune and honor of working in depth with Paulo Freire in 1984, when he lived with me for a month and collaborated in the social justice movement building activities of the Adult Education Development Project. We discussed at length how his theory was being taken up in different sectors in different countries. He agreed with me that much of the critical pedagogy that takes place in U.S. schools and claims Frege's theory as its basis is in truth a domestication of the radical foundation of his ideas, even as it establishes a more humane form of schooling. Education as a practice of freedom is necessarily geared into actual efforts and struggles to transform the world and to transform our own inner selves as well, since the oppressions of the world reside in us as well as in the structures and processes of daily life. But Frege was not a purist in terms of either theory or practice. He was committed to doing whatever could be done in whatever open spaces could be created, so he would be happy that people the world over have found his theory useful in their own ways, in their own particular context, to move the struggle for justice forward. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? A university based in Freire's theory would be organized to address the most pressing social, economic, and political inequities. It would take direction for its research agenda from the needs of the most aggrieved communities. It would recognize the ethical and political dimensions of knowledge claims and knowledge production. It would honor multiple modalities of knowing. It would acknowledge that scholars and their disciplines and universities are themselves tainted by histories and ideologies of oppression and exploitation. It would be less concerned with credentialing experts than it would be concerned with animating curiosity, habits of disciplined critical inquiry, and a lifetime commitment to the struggle for justice. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on pedagogy? I think in the United States, Freire's work has had limited impact on pedagogy in schools. I see his theory primarily invoked as an ethical or political marker, as an indication of a teacher's intent to honor the background experiences of students. This is usually done through and often somewhat superficial engagement with Chapter 2 of Pedagogy of the Oppressed and its famous contrast between banking and dialogical or problem-posing education. This domesticated critical pedagogy certainly is more humane, provides more space for student voice and interests, and offers a counterposition to the dominant discourse and practice of pedagogy in public schools. However, this is a very limited embodiment of the theory. It is the case that some teachers, such as those organized in Teachers for Social Justice, have developed more robust embodiments of the theory and are looking for ways to link classroom learning to larger movements seeking to effect change in the community. Freire's theory has been used pedagogically within movement building, and here it has found much stronger forms of expression, particularly in Latin America. Valerie Kinlock, University of Pittsburgh, USA. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I am the René and Richard Goldman Dean of the School of Education at the University of Pittsburgh, where I collaborate with colleagues on important local, national, and global educational initiatives. Before being named Dean, I was Professor of Literacy Studies and Associate Dean at Ohio State University, where I facilitated initiatives on diversity and inclusion in education, international education partnerships, and school and community engagement. My research examines the literacies and community engagements of young people and adults inside and outside schools. I'm the author of publications on race, place, literacy, and diversity, and I'm currently working on related research and engagement initiatives. How did you come to read Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed for the first time? I discovered Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed when I was an undergraduate student majoring in English at Johnson C. Smith University. I recall having countless conversations with my friends and some of my professors about black literature, black lives, oppression, and the power of language and literacy, and I was moved to continue on my journey to read various texts by black authors and scholars. In one of those texts, the idea of reading the word and the world was presented to me, and when I searched for the meaning of the phrase, Paulo Freire's name and book came up. So I read Pedagogy of the Oppressed and fell in love with his discussion of critical consciousness and connections that should happen among teachers, students, and the world. What do you think a Freire University would look like today? I think it would include open spaces for people to engage with others, to analyze events going on in the world, to examine ways to combat oppression and inequity, to dismantle racism, classism, sexism, inequality, and capitalism. It would be free, open to everyone. It would be guided by the need to create and enhance our stances, dispositions, and ideologies related to critical consciousness, collaborating with others, working for necessary socio-political change, and thinking beyond the self. It would be a humanizing, culturally rich academic space. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on research? To this day, Freire continues to push scholars to consider the complicated ways identities and locations need to be nuanced in discussions about education. He encourages us to take a critical perspective, especially when collaborating with other people in community contexts, as we attempt to address pervasive questions about inequality. He also situates research within the reach of the everyday realities, lives, lived conditions, struggles, and hope of people, to make research accessible to who we are working with and writing with and about in our research. Thus, research is not singularly about publishing articles and books, but about writing new ways of being into existence that can, fundamentally, change the world for the better. If students took just one thing away from reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed, what would you hope it would be? I hope it would be this. Freire's 1971 insistence that we work to eradicate systems of oppression so that students can become beings for themselves, as opposed to students being forced to integrate into the structure of oppression, page 55. I believe his focus on transforming systems of oppression points to all systems, schools, universities, and political systems that we live under in our specific contexts. It also speaks to the need for us to work in solidarity to revolutionize and transform the world. Peter Mayo, University of Malta, Malta. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I was brought up in Malta, where I worked as a part-time journalist for a few years, then took up teaching and eventually the academic life after having pursued postgraduate studies at the University of Alberta and OISE, University of Toronto in Canada. I specialize in sociology of education with a focus on adult education, and have also been involved in university outreach developing projects that have their basis in issues and commemorations that capture community members' imagination and are therefore rooted in popular consciousness. How did you come to read Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed for the first time? The occasion for reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed presented itself at the start of my graduate studies in Edmonton, Alberta, and the book certainly proved a revelation to me. It seemed to contain many of the insights and elements necessary for me to understand the context in which my previous teaching in Malta had taken place. These included subalternity, colonial legacies, relative poverty, class issues including language issues, and issues concerning racism. There were African Maltese students in our school at a time when Maltese society was nowhere near the multi-ethnic society it has become in recent times. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? It would be one wherein the institution and the education it provides are conceived of as public goods, not consumption goods. It would be one where engagement with the community would be given central importance. It would be one where the starting point for learning is the student's existential situation, with knowledge deriving from thematic complexes researched within and emerging from the community. It would be one in which the transmission model of lecturing is replaced by co-investigation, involving lecturers, students, and community members, debating issues which are raised in a manner that arouses epistemological curiosity and becomes the object of collective inquiry. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on research? The greatest Freirean impact on research can be felt in that approach known as participatory action research, a collective form of research where community members are assisted in researching issues that affect their own and surrounding lives. I would argue that Freire has a lot to tell us about the ethics of research and the extent to which those whose lives and issues are being examined are genuinely involved in determining the research agenda and research process. They would benefit from co-ownership of the entire research process and its outcomes. This research process and outcome should serve to improve their ways of life. It is a value-committed effort which affirms the choice and purposes of research in line with a view that knowledge and research are not neutral. In short, it is research geared not simply to interpret the world, but primarily to contribute toward changing it. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on pedagogy? Freire has inspired many to move away from a hierarchical, magisterial mode of teaching and learning to a more democratic approach, an approach built on the teacher's democratic authority, which does not degenerate into authoritarianism. He has also inspired educators to recognize the politics of education and knowledge, to eschew any pretense of neutrality, and most important of all, he has emphasized the collective dimensions of learning and the need to start from the learner's existential situations with all their differences and move to higher orders of learning and knowledge. Peter McLaren, Chapman University, USA. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. I served as an elementary school teacher in Toronto's Jane Finch Corridor, a public housing district in Canada known for its high rate of crime. I earned a hard-won reputation for successfully teaching working-class immigrants. I subsequently applied for and was accepted into a PhD program in education at the University of Toronto, during which time I published the diary I had kept as an elementary school teacher. I called it Cries from the Corridor, and it became a Canadian bestseller in 1980. After I'd finished a grueling national book tour, I was already growing self-critical about the fact that Cries from the Corridor was woefully absent of a theoretical framework that could help readers understand the violence and alienation experienced by students in my classroom. Progressive and radical educators alike had for decades winced in gut-churning unison at the tellingly restrained efforts to take seriously education reform throughout the country, establishing a bog-standard evasion for challenging seriously the role that education plays in the reproduction of the asymmetrical relations of power and privilege of the capitalist state. And I fear that my book was not sufficiently helpful in deepening an understanding of capitalist schooling. To remedy both the calculated indifference of educational officials as well as my insufficiently developed theoretical center of gravity, I began to read across disciplines, shifting my early interest in Chaucer, Beowulf, Shakespeare, and Blake towards an incorporation of the sociology of knowledge, anthropology, critical theory, and semiotics. I took the time to audit courses with Michael Foucault, Umberto Eco, Ernesto Laclau, and other visiting intellectuals. I finally graduated with my doctorate in 1984, still feeling that there was so much to learn. My doctoral dissertation was published as a book, Schooling as a Ritual Performance, and to my great excitement, Professor Henri Giraud agreed to write the preface. Henri became a mentor to me and invited me to join him at Miami University of Ohio as a fellow professor. Henri introduced me to one of his best friends, Donaldo Macedo, from whom I learned a great deal about Paulo Freire and his work. Henri arranged for me to meet Paulo in 1985, and I was surprised, no, shocked, to learn that Paulo was already familiar with my work. In fact, he would refer to me as his intellectual cousin and a part of his pedagogical family. In the ensuing years, he was gracious enough to write prefaces for two of my books and an endorsement for a third. In subsequent years, until his death, he exhibited a soulful kindness toward me and my ongoing project of developing critical pedagogy in North America, and later primarily Latin America and Asian contexts. How did you come to read Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed for the first time? I read Pedagogy of the Oppressed while a doctoral student in Toronto. It was not on any required reading lists in my classes, but friends of mine on the left pronounced it as a must-read work, so I read it in conjunction with other educators and social and political theorists that I was reading at the time. Paulo's work stood out for its relevance to my own life experiences, both as a student and as an educator, dramatically so. It helped to sharpen my understanding of praxis and the necessity for engaging in social struggles and then returning to theoretical and philosophical works for clarification and for deepening my understanding of those experiences. What do you think Paulo Freire would say about how his theories are used today? I think Paulo, in all of his great humility, would be appreciative that his work has made such a powerful impact on so many fields and that it has become such a powerful antidote to prevailing forms of social and political amnesia and to the motivated forgetfulness that surrounds the foundational violence of all societies. But I also believe he would be critical of approaches in education that claim to be Freirean, but which domesticated his work, leeching from its foundations a radical politics that was critical of capitalism and which could certainly be called socialist. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? A Freirean university in the North American context would be centered around the elimination of economic inequality and social relations of oppression related to sexuality, age, species, gender, white supremacy, and the coloniality of power, all of which are related in different ways to the unequal ownership of capital and to capitalist value production itself, and the exploitation, alienation, and logic of abstraction that accompanies it. The unequal ownership of capital cannot be remedied by higher growth rates within the conceptual models of neoclassical economics, but only by transcending capitalism through a socialist alternative. The Freirean University will be about rebuilding public sectors, democratizing the workplace, establishing communal councils that are committed to models of participatory and direct democracy, eliminating race, class, and gender antagonisms, creating a revolutionary critical humanism that transcends private property and that is committed to creating communities of engaged learners and freely associated laborers dedicated to working in the interests of a truly global commons. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on research? Freire's work has had a strikingly significant impact on the genesis and ongoing development of the field of critical pedagogy. Critical pedagogy is constituted by a body of theory associated with Freire's work, and critical social theory more generally that emphasizes praxis. The field of critical pedagogy has recently expanded its purview to include revolutionary critical pedagogy, an attempt to reclaim Freire's Marxist epistemological roots through the development of a philosophy of praxis driven primarily by the work of Marx, Hegel, and humanist philosophers. Freire's research has been felt in the fields of theology, literacy, composition studies, literary studies, applied linguistics, sociology, anthropology, and political philosophy. That his work has cross-fertilized so many areas of research is a testament to its transdisciplinary reach in the service of a truly decolonial pedagogy of hope and self and social transformation. If students took just one thing away from reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed, what would you hope it would be? It would be that they would never just take one thing away from reading Paulo Freire, but realize that their everyday lives always have pedagogical dimensions to them, and those pedagogical dimensions are in turn and at one and the same time political dimensions that challenge our obligation to the poor, the immiserated, and the dispossessed, that sharpen our ontological and epistemological clarity, and that challenge our commitment to building a better world free from unnecessary alienation and human suffering. Margot Okazawa Ray, San Francisco State University, USA, and Fielding Graduate University, USA. Please tell us about your background and current areas of expertise. My primary areas of work, teaching, research, and activism, focus on militarism, armed conflict, and violence against women. I've examined the connections between militarism, economic globalization, and impacts on local and migrant women in South Korea who live and work around U.S. military bases. I've conducted feminist activist research methodology training sessions with women activists in the Niger Delta region, Ghana, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. I use popular education in community settings to conduct anti-racist and multicultural workshops, and in my undergraduate and graduate courses. How did you come to read Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed for the first time? In the late 1970s, a small group of feminist activists in Boston, USA, began to read and learn from Pedagogy of the Oppressed together, striving to understand and create radical methodologies for living, understanding, and teaching the feminist slogan, the personal is political. What better way than through ideas we learn from Freire? We did not realize before that the feminist consciousness-raising groups were based on, or at least unknowingly related to, his work. The writing was turgid, and we were sometimes challenged by masculinist language of he, him, and men. Nonetheless, we carried on to our enormous benefit. What do you think Paulo Freire would say about how his theories are used today? I had the honor of meeting Freire in person in the 1980s and was struck by his unpretentiousness, his simplicity. So I believe he would be surprised, pleasantly, by the extensive use of his work by a range of educators around the world. He also would be seriously concerned and dismayed by the distortion and debasement of key ideas, like starting from students' experiences, reading the world to read the word, to technocratic concepts like learner-centered, that have come to mean you students can have some say in what you learn, but we teachers still control the curriculum. Perhaps more important, the liberatory purpose of education that Freire so consistently articulated and re-articulated has been left to one side on the way to increasingly mechanized learning and teaching contexts in public education for primary, secondary, and tertiary students. Freire would delight truly at the uptake of his work in places similar to where he began, in rural areas of the world, including in developed countries like the United States, where peasants and working-class folk, with and without literacy skills, are learning to analyze, understand, and change the conditions that oppress and marginalize them. What do you think a Freirean university would look like today? Freirean university would be an oxymoron today. The forces of neoliberalism and conservatism that have engulfed most universities would result in the same harm being inflicted currently, irrespective of a name change. The most radical educational settings that could faithfully apply and advance Freire's work would be in informal settings, what I refer to as free spaces, including activist movements, and within formal settings like universities, where we could learn and teach together as we face material and social conditions that are so heavily and horrifically shaping our lives, and recognize our shared destinies, oppressed and oppressor, dominant and subordinate, the vocal and the silent and silenced. Can you describe how and to what extent you think Freire's work has had an impact on research? Liberatory methodologies that I'm most familiar with, feminist and decolonizing, are rooted in Freirean, feminist, and indigenous epistemologies and research methods. I've experienced how Paulo Freire's theories have been applied creatively and convincingly in both. Forward to the original English edition, 1970. Richard Schall. Over the years, the thought and work of the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire have spread from the northeast of Brazil to an entire continent and have made a profound impact not only in the field of education, but also in the overall struggle for national development. At the precise moment when the disinherited masses in Latin America are awakening from their traditional lethargy and are anxious to participate as subjects in the development of their countries, Paulo Freire has perfected a method of teaching illiterates that has contributed in an extraordinary way to that process. In fact, those who, in learning to read and write, come to a new awareness of selfhood and begin to look critically at the social situation in which they find themselves, often take the initiative in acting to transform the society that has denied them from this opportunity of participation. Education is once again a subversive force. In this country, we are gradually becoming aware of the work of Paulo Freire, but thus far we have thought of it primarily in terms of its contribution to the education of illiterate adults in the Third World. If, however, we take a closer look, we may discover that his methodology as well as his educational philosophy are as important for us as for the dispossessed in Latin America. Their struggle to become free subjects and to participate in the transformation of their society is similar in many ways to the struggle not only of blacks and Mexican Americans, but also of middle-class young people in this country. And the sharpness and intensity of that struggle in the developing world may well provide us with new insight, new models, and a new hope as we face our own situation. For this reason, I consider the publication of Pedagogy of the Oppressed in an English edition to be something of an event. Paulo Freire's thought represents the response of a creative mind and sensitive conscience to the extraordinary misery and suffering of the oppressed around him. Born in 1921 in Recife, the center of one of the most extreme situations of poverty and underdevelopment in the Third World, he was soon forced to experience that reality directly. As the economic crisis in 1929 in the United States began to affect Brazil, the precarious stability of Freire's middle-class family gave way, and he found himself sharing the plight of the wretched of the earth. This had a profound influence on his life as he came to know the gnawing pangs of hunger and fell behind in school because of the listlessness it produced. It also led him to make a vow at age 11 to dedicate his life to the struggle against hunger so that other children would not have to know the agony he was then experiencing. His early sharing of the life of the poor also led him to the discovery of what he describes as the culture of silence of the dispossessed. He came to realize that their ignorance and lethargy were the direct product of the whole situation of economic, social, and political domination, and of the paternalism of which they were victims. Rather than being encouraged and equipped to know and respond to the concrete realities of their world, they were kept submerged in a situation in which such critical awareness and response were practically impossible. And it became clear to him that the whole educational system was one of the major instruments for the maintenance of this culture of silence. Confronted by this problem in a very existential way, Freire turned his attention to the field of education and began to work on it. Over the years, he has engaged in the process of study and reflection that has produced something quite new and creative in educational philosophy. From a situation of direct engagement in the struggle to liberate men and women for the creation of a new world, he has reached out to the thought and experience of those in many different situations and of diverse philosophical positions. In his words, to Sartre and Mounir, Eric Fromm and Louis Althusser, Ortega y Gasset and Mao, Martin Luther King and Che Guevara, Unamuno and Marcuse, he has made use of the insights of these men to develop a perspective on education which is authentically his own and which seeks to respond to the concrete realities of Latin America. His thought on the philosophy of education was first expressed in 1959 in his doctoral dissertation at the University of Recife, and later in his work as professor of the history and philosophy of education in the same university, as well as in his early experiments with the teaching of illiterates in that same city. The methodology he developed was widely used by Catholics and others in literacy campaigns throughout the northeast of Brazil, and was considered such a threat to the old order that Freire was jailed immediately after the military coup in 1964. Released 70 days later and encouraged to leave the country, Freire went to Chile, where he spent 5 years working with UNESCO and the Chilean Institute for Agrarian Reform in programs of adult education. He then acted as a consultant at Harvard University's School of Education and worked in close association with a number of groups engaged in new educational experiments in rural and urban areas. He's presently serving as special consultant to the Office of Education of the World Council of Churches in Geneva. Freire has written many articles in Portuguese and Spanish, and his first book, Educação como Prática da Liberdade, was published in Brazil in 1967. His latest and most complete work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is the first of his writings to be published in this country. In this brief introduction, there is no point in attempting to sum up in a few paragraphs what the author develops in a number of pages. That would be an offense to the richness, depth, and complexity of his thought. But perhaps a word of witness has its place here, a personal witness as to why I find a dialogue with the thought of Paulo Freire an exciting adventure. Fed up as I am with the abstractness and sterility of so much intellectual work in academic circles today, I'm excited by a process of reflection which is set in a thoroughly historical context, which is carried on in the midst of a struggle to create a new social order and thus represents a new unity of theory and praxis. I am encouraged when a man of the stature of Paulo Freire incarnates a rediscovery of the humanizing vocation of the intellectual and demonstrates the power of thought to negate accepted limits and open the way to a new future. Freire is able to do this because he operates on one basic assumption, that man's ontological vocation, as he calls it, is to be a subject who acts upon and transforms his world, and in doing so moves toward ever new possibilities of fuller and richer life individually and collectively. This world to which he relates is not a static and closed order, a given reality which man must accept and to which he must adjust. Rather, it is a problem to be worked on and solved. It is the material used by man to create history, a task which he performs as he overcomes that which is dehumanizing at any particular time and place, and dares to create the qualitatively new. For Freire, the resources of that task at the present time are provided by the advanced technology of our Western world. But the social vision which impels us to negate the present order and demonstrate that history is not ended comes primarily from the suffering and struggle of the people of the Third World. Coupled with this is Freire's conviction, now supported by a wide background of experience, that every human being, no matter how ignorant or submerged in the culture of silence he or she may be, is capable of looking critically at the world in a dialogical encounter with others. Provided with the proper tools for such encounter, the individual can gradually perceive personal and social reality as well as the contradictions in it, become conscious of his or her own perception of that reality, and deal critically with it. In this process, the old paternalistic teacher-student relationship is overcome. A peasant can facilitate this process for a neighbor more effectively than a teacher brought in from outside. People educate each other through the mediation of the world. As this happens, the word takes on new power. It is no longer an abstraction or magic, but a means by which people discover themselves and their potential as they give names to things around them. As Freire puts it, each individual wins back the right to say his or her own word to name the world. When an illiterate peasant participates in this sort of educational experience, he or she comes to a new awareness of self, has a new sense of dignity, and is stirred by a new hope. Time and again, peasants have expressed these discoveries in striking ways after a few hours of class. I now realize I am a person, an educated person. We were blind, now our eyes have been opened. Before this, words meant nothing to me. Now they speak to me, and I can make them speak. Now we will no longer be a dead weight on the cooperative farm. When this happens in the process of learning to read, men and women discover that they are creators of culture, and that all their work can be creative. I work, and working I transform the world. And as those who have been completely marginalized are so radically transformed, they are no longer willing to be mere objects, responding to changes occurring around them. They are more likely to decide to take upon themselves the struggle to change the structures of society, which until now have served to oppress them. For this reason, a distinguished Brazilian student of national development recently affirmed that this type of educational work among the people represents a new factor in social change and development, a new instrument of conduct for the Third World by which it can overcome traditional structures and enter the modern world. At first sight, Paulo Freire's method of teaching illiterates in Latin America seems to belong to a different world from that in which we find ourselves in this country. Certainly, it would be absurd to claim that it should be copied here. But there are certain parallels in the two situations that should not be overlooked. Our advanced technological society is rapidly making objects of most of us and subtly programming us into conformity to the logic of its system. To the degree that this happens, we are also becoming submerged in a new culture of silence. The paradox that is the same technology that does this to us also creates a new sensitivity to what is happening. Especially among young people, the new media, together with the erosion of old concepts of authority, open the way to acute awareness of this new bondage. The young perceive that their right to say their own word has been stolen from them, and that few things are more important than the struggle to win it back. They also realize that the educational system today, from kindergarten to university, is their enemy. There is no such thing as a neutral educational process. Education either functions as an instrument that is used to facilitate the integration of the younger generation into the logic of the present system and bring about conformity to it, or it becomes the practice of freedom, the means by which men and women deal critically and creatively with reality and discover how to participate in the transformation of their world. The development of an educational methodology that facilitates this process will inevitably lead to tension and conflict within our society. But it could also contribute to the formation of a new man and mark the beginning of a new era in Western history. For those who are committed to that task and are searching for concepts and tools for experimentation, Paulo Freire's thought will make a significant contribution in the years ahead. This concludes Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. Narrated by Dennis Kleinman. Copyright 1970-1993 by Paulo Freire. Copyright 2018 by Paulo Freire and contributors. Copyright Introduction 2018 by Donaldo Macedo. Copyright Afterword 2018 by Ira Shaw. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Bloomsbury Publishing PLC UK, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.